Welcome to Mad Coast Radio, diligent dialogue, dismantling crazy, one conversation at a time. Join me, your host, Susie DeKnight, as we explore all things mental and behavioral health related. Welcome to Mad Coast Radio. I'm your host, Susie DeKnight. My guest today is Rory Gerard. Rory is a licensed professional counselor and provider of mental and behavioral health treatment services at North Coast Counseling in Astoria. And he's a dual diagnosis provider for a local alcohol and other drug treatment facility. I asked Rory to join me today on Mad Coast Radio to talk about dual diagnosis, what it is, some common treatments, and what the typical person might like to know for themselves or others. Welcome, Rory Gerard.
Well, thank you for having me today, Susie. I appreciate the opportunity.
Let's just start at the beginning. What is dual diagnosis?
So dual diagnosis is, maybe I should start with, we have traditionally mental health treatment, and then we have addictions treatment. And those two were sort of in separate domains for many, many years. And along about 1985 or so, people started looking at, well, my client has depression and they're drinking. What do I do with that? How do I treat that? And what we had been doing was treating either one or the other, and that didn't seem to have good outcomes. So along about 1985 or so, this conversation started up in the provider communities, and we came up with a term, dual diagnosis, or sometimes co-occurring disordered, and a term for someone who experiences a mental health illness and a substance abuse problem simultaneously. But dual diagnosis, or COD, co-occurring, is kind of a broad category. And you can imagine that there are as many substances to abuse as there are mental illnesses to experience. And there can be any kind of combination between the two. And either the substance abuse or the mental illness can develop first. It's not one tends to be more than the other. And so consequently, I was looking at some numbers. It seems that 2.7 million adults, that's 18 years or older, 40% of these people had never received treatment for a dual diagnosis services out of the 24 million people who were in reported psychiatric distress. So it's a fairly common occurrence. And more so, we're seeing that specifically certain drugs can cause very specific mental illnesses. Methamphetamine, for example, meth psychosis is a common result from using meth. And we know that that psychosis needs to be treated simultaneously as treating the methamphetamine addiction. It does not necessarily clear up when you've stopped using the drug. Drugs can have lasting effects on our psyche. A person experiencing a mental health condition may turn to drugs or alcohol as a form of self-medication to improve the troubling mental health symptoms that they experience. Now, this phrase kind of gets tossed around a lot as, oh, they're self-medicating. There is a lot of truth to that. We have to attend to the symptoms of the mental illness so that we can also attend to the symptoms of the addiction. A research shows, though, that drugs and alcohol only make the symptoms of mental health conditions worse. So people who say they smoke marijuana because it eases their depression, the research shows again and again and again that marijuana actually can exacerbate psychiatric symptoms, especially in young people. And alcohol, although people may feel good initially, it is a depressant and it makes them feel more depressed. Abusing substances can also lead to mental health problems because of the effects drugs have on the person's moods, thoughts, brain chemistry, or behavior. I sort of spoke to that earlier. And so that's sort of, in a nutshell, what dual diagnosis really is.
So dual diagnosis doesn't refer simply to two diagnoses. It's specific to the presence of a mental health diagnosis as well as a substance abuse concern.
Exactly.
And so you mentioned, I can't help but notice that, you know, I think a lot of listeners may wonder about this with the, you know, legalization of marijuana. And you mentioned that, you know, a lot of people think that they take marijuana for one thing, for their mental health condition, but actually it create more of an impairment. Is that true across the board? I know some people talk about the medicinal properties of marijuana as something that, you know, can be used for anxiety or other, you know, people get a medical card so that they can use it for treatment. And I'm just sort of curious how that intersects with the work that you do in dual diagnosis or sort of what the treatment community might be thinking about that, if you have any comments on that.
I don't know that I could speak to the treatment community at large. I think generally on the CD, the chemical dependency side of things, it's abstinence only. That's typically, and that's what the state will require, schools will require. In a lot of ways, we're in a great experiment right now with the legalization of marijuana. And now that it's more open and more available, we're going to have more and more research. And I think we're still very polarized in, you know, the pro cannabis is, you know, marijuana is great for everything under the sun, and the anti-cannabis, which is everything is, you know, it's terrible and it should be outlawed. I'm not on that argument. I work from a perspective of dual diagnosis with harm reduction model, which says, how can I reduce my risk? And if I am experiencing psychosis when I smoke marijuana, then I probably need to consider not smoking marijuana. It's not my job to tell you to do that. It's a legal substance that you can purchase. It's the same with alcohol. People drink casually, socially, all the time without any consequence. But some people drink and they have immediate consequences that are negative and impact their lives substantially. They probably are the people that don't need to drink. So it's not an across the board kind of, it's either this or that. I think everyone's unique and needs to be treated in that way.
So can you speak to why does dual diagnosis have its own special name? The combination of chemical dependency and mental illness, there are a lot of co-occurring disorders, right? That it just, there's a lot of different ways that a person can experience both a mental health diagnosis as well as some other medical, you know.
Thyroid comes to mind. Mm. When people's thyroids are out of whack, they can become very psychotic. Or if you're diabetic and you have low blood sugar or high blood sugar, they can cause a psychiatric event. Working in crisis in the emergency rooms, I've seen all kinds of things triggering folks. So I think there was a push for the nomenclature of dual diagnosis to set it sort of in between CD treatment, chemical dependency treatment, and mental health treatment. One of the founders of that is actually a gentleman who I had the honor of working with years ago, way back in 95. His name was Corbett Monica, who he recently passed, I think, 2 years ago, maybe. But Corbett was one of the main driving forces behind this concept of dual diagnosis. And in fact, was the one who helped create and nurture the Dual Diagnosis Anonymous support group. And so I think there was this this effort to really give it the attention that it needed. Often what happened was people who were in addiction languished and suffered because of their mental health conditions weren't being treated. So it really brought fair light onto that. A lot of work came out of University of Dartmouth. And Minkoff was his name, the gentleman who I happened to be honored to sit in on some sessions with, really kind of drove home this concept that we have to treat both things at the same time. If you're depressed and break your leg, we're going to cast your leg and we're going to treat your depression. Why would we not do it with any other event?
So does that mean that mental health providers and addiction treatment providers work well together?
I think that there's always challenges. You have folks that come from two very separate, distinct education traditions. And, you know, you're always going to have your hardliners who are going to say, well, we just have to do it this way first and that way second. More and more, though, the schools are approaching this concept of dual diagnostics to better understand the bigger picture of the client. And so even though there isn't a diagnosis of dual diagnosis, either in chemical dependency treatment or in mental health treatment, what we're doing is we're starting to bring those two together in a multidisciplinary approach. So typically in an agency setting, you're going to have a CD person, a case manager, a mental health provider, a doc, hopefully, or a nurse practitioner, all sitting at the table discussing client cases and strategizing for treatment. And it's shared. It's a shared experience. We don't usually have that just CD or just mental health treatment anymore. We don't see a lot of that.
And by CD, you're referring to chemical dependency.
Correct. I'm sorry. Yeah.
That's okay. Just for those who don't live and breathe mental health and addiction
and acronyms.
Acronyms. We are full of them. So tell me, what are some of the common treatments and tips for managing a dual diagnosis situation, or a person who maybe is experiencing, or someone who knows someone who's experiencing challenges with a mental health diagnosis as well as a chemical dependency or addiction of any kind?
So I think one of the things that is important to remember is, first of all, we need to see someone who is trained both in mental health and addiction to do our assessment. People present differently with different people. So I may go into one office and talk to a drug and alcohol counselor, and they're going to be very focused on my use history and quantity of use and negative consequences of use. And if I say, yeah, and I've been depressed, it might be, oh, well, it's because you've had these negative consequences and a person should, you know, normally feels depressed from that, versus having the training to ask the questions to unpack that depression. So do you experience that more than 2 weeks? Can you remember before you started using, did you experience depression? What was that like? Did you eat less, eat more? Did you sleep more, sleep less? All of these questions, but you got to take a person back to a time prior to them being under the influence, which can be exceedingly difficult if you have, especially working with young people, you're talking about someone when they were 10 years old. Amazingly, they recall. We remember when we were depressed when we were kids, because we felt different from other people. So that in and of itself is having that clinically trained person, both in addictions and mental health, doing your assessment to evaluate both at the same time.
And then, so you've gone in, let's just sit, to kind of follow this thread. You've gone in, you've gotten your assessment, and the person, say they meet with you, you're trained in both, so you're able to respond to the needs of someone who is experiencing a mental health issue and also chemical dependency or addiction. Then what? Yes, okay, I need help. Now what?
So what we want to do, if in terms of the, this is where it becomes a bit of a juggling act for the clinician. What we want to do is determine what your risk level is with your current use. If I believe, and from the information that you've given me, that you are in need of detox, you know, you need to go to a medical bed where you can withdraw from the medication or the substance that you're on, what we want to make sure is that they don't detox you off of everything. In other words, what has happened in some cases is they've taken away the psychotropic medications as well, and then we have to start all of that back up again. There are some treatment facilities that are zero medications, and that's probably not good for a person who may have been taking psychotropic medications during their addiction, before their addiction, and will be needing to take them after they're sober.
You also mentioned earlier harm reduction, and I'm wondering, we know that in some instances of, say, a severe mental illness, a person may or may not be able to maintain 100% sobriety. Is that correct? And so is there a different kind of response when you're responding to a more severe mental illness in terms of treatment, or whether or not you choose to apply harm reduction versus a 12-step sobriety model, which says abstinence only?
Ooh, boy, this is where I'm going to answer very cautiously. When I was referring to harm reduction earlier, I was being very specific to marijuana use. When we look at other drugs like heroin or heroin, one cannot typically stop suddenly without medical attention. Long-term alcohol use cannot be stopped without, you know, medical attention. Sometimes that includes something like an alcohol drip, IV, to wean the person off. With heroin, we often use other drugs to treat the heroin addiction to help them avoid the painfulness of withdrawal. So in a sense, that can be a harm reduction model, as we're using other drugs to treat drug addiction. Now, hopefully, we're going to wean people off of them completely. In terms of chronic and persistent illness, it's very difficult for someone who's experiencing psychosis and maybe not having a firm grip on reality to understand the negative impacts of, say, marijuana use or alcohol use. And what we have to do is figure out the right setting to help them sustain sobriety. Most psychotropic medications don't respond well when there are other drugs in your system. So it's why we proceed very cautiously, working with psychiatrists, with nurse practitioners, with case managers can help monitor, and doing a lot of group settings where we can process with folks what their experiences are so that they can better manage their sobriety and their good mental health.
And it sounds like all of that kind of goes back to your original point, which is how is their quality of life? And does your behavior, using drugs or alcohol and other drugs, does it get in the way of you being able to function in the way that allows you to feel healthy and do all the things that you want to do in life? And it sounds like regardless of where you are on the mental health continuum, that is the goal, is to kind of figure out what services and what kind of interventions are needed to help a person achieve the life that they want to live, regardless of what other things are getting in the way. Is that right?
I would agree with that. And I think, you know, what came to my mind as you were speaking was the idea that, is this person, my question is almost always, are you trying to manage a mental health symptom with your drugs and alcohol? That's one of the first questions I ask someone who has told me they have a mental health issue, an established diagnosis, so to speak, because typically some medications don't work very well, and people often have to try several medications before they find one that works. And, you know, we understand in the treatment community that people try to manage their health as best they can. When we're sick with a cold, as I've been recently, I go to the pharmacy and I get NyQuil or whatever, you know, cold decongestants. I treat myself. I don't go to a doctor for just a run-of-the-mill cold. it seems then that it's understandable that someone may try to treat their depression, anxiety. Well, if I'm feeling really anxious and I have a drink, I don't feel so anxious afterwards. And so what we want to do as a treatment provider is look at other options for treatment than self-medicating with alcohol or drugs.
You're listening to an interview with Rory Gerard on Mad Coast Radio, KMUN Astoria, KCTB, Tillamook. Rory, just to follow up with that last piece there, what are some of the alternative treatments that you might use, say, in your private practice when you're working with someone around the concerns of dual diagnosis?
So, you know, I think part of this is really about how many, my metaphor is how many people can I get in my boat to help me row upriver? And so that means, where's family in this setting? Are there people in your family or your family of choice that can help you maintain your sobriety? Maybe it's someone that'll just remind you each day without being judgmental, are you still taking your meds? Or can I help you get to the pharmacy to get your meds? Or can I help you get to your appointment, even though I know you feel really depressed today and you don't want to leave bed? We need to get you in to see your counselor or your doctor. And then I think we want to look at support groups like AA, NA, any of the A's, I call it. And specifically, my plug for Dual Diagnosis Anonymous, which is very specific to treating both addiction and mental health. We actually have here locally a group down in Seaside that meets twice a week. They're starting a group in Warrington that will meet weekly. And I'm hoping to get one started up here in Astoria here in short order. But it's the traditional 12 steps with 5 additional steps. So they call it 12 plus 5. And those 5 steps are really centered around meeting with your counselor, maintaining compliance with medication regimes, and that kind of thing.
And just to be clear, the 12 steps that you're talking about are the 12 steps that most people commonly refer to when they're thinking of the sobriety community of Alcoholics Anonymous or Narcotics Anonymous. And so let's say a listener is thinking, oh, well, I really want to get help, or I know someone that wants that I would like to help get help. They would potentially find either you or someone like you in the community. But let's say they have Oregon Health Plan. And we know that in our local region, if you have Oregon Health Plan, you generally are mandated to go to your local community-based mental health facility. In Clatsop County, that would be Clatsop Behavioral Healthcare. In Tillamook, that would be Tillamook Family Counseling Center, and across the river, Willapa Behavioral Health. Mm-hmm. So in those, I know that in those facilities, generally chemical dependency or alcohol and other drug treatment is relegated to its own department. Mm-hmm. And those are the individuals who work in that department are trained and educated to treat chemical dependency or alcohol and other drug treatment. And then if a person also needs mental health assistance, then they would go to the other department, which would be the mental health department. And I'm not totally clear how much communication happens between the two. So I'm curious if you could maybe give some tips to our listeners about how they can advocate for themselves in order to make sure that communication is happening either between the two providers or that they are able to communicate to each of the providers. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. And you bring up a very good point. Sometimes that communication is lacking. And part of just a little background, the way that treatment has been funded traditionally by the federal government was from 2 separate agencies, substance abuse and mental health, and then NIMH, National Institutes of Mental Health. And then there was another body, federal body, to attend to drug and alcohol. So these funding streams came in separate, and they restricted what treatments could be provided within the scope of that funding. So this is what kept us sort of siloed in these different treatment efforts. More and more folks are being joined together. So here's what you have to do as a client. You have to take responsibility for your own treatment. And that means, if that includes getting a copy of the note that your alcohol and drug counselor wrote today, and taking that with you when you meet with your mental health practitioner, or if they share the same computer systems, ask them to bring up the most recent progress note that one or the other has written. You also are going to want treatment plans that attend to your addiction and attend to your mental health concern. And you need to have copies of those in your hands. Make a little folder and keep track of this. And have this conversation each time you go to see one or the other. And that way, you know that everyone on board is communicating. Additionally, you're going to take that to your prescriber as well, because he or she may not know what treatments you're receiving, especially if you're receiving them at another location. And as we struggle with having psychiatric prescriber resources on the coast, you may see someone outside of an agency where you're receiving services, and they may not necessarily be communicating. So it really is on the client.
Yeah, I really appreciate you bringing up that point. I think that making sure whether you are whatever kind of treatment services you're receiving, making sure that you're talking to your medical provider about those services, especially if you are getting medication for treatment of something that you are also seeing another provider for. It's important that everyone that you're seeing knows what medications you're taking, what kind of treatment you're getting, what you're being asked to do, and how you're able to follow through with that. And then also maybe where you might need some help with that. Rory, we're coming to the end of our show. Will you tell the listeners how to contact you and maybe even where they can learn more about today's topic of dual diagnosis?
So in terms of the topic of dual diagnosis, I'm going to point folks to the direction of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, NAMI, N-A-M-I, website, www.nami.com, or org, I guess. And then also for the point them towards the Dual Diagnosis of Oregon, all one word, DDA of Oregon. .com. And that's the dual diagnosis website here in our state. And those two places will give you a wealth of knowledge and resources to contact folks. Additionally, people can feel free to give me a call. My number is 503-515-2545. You can text, you can call. And also you can email me at North Coast Counseling, all one word, @outlook.com, and I'd be happy to answer your questions or concerns.
Thank you so much, Rory Gerard, a return guest on Mad Coast Radio, and always a great resource. I encourage everyone to reach out to Rory if you have any questions. He's a huge advocate in our community, and what he can't provide for you, he'll connect you with the person who can. Please join me in sending out love vibes of strength and support to all those who still suffer and are doing their best to keep on keeping on. You are not alone. Veterans, we see you, we support you. Getting help is always an act of courage. If you or someone you know is feeling hopeless, not sure where to turn, thinking about suicide, please, please call 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-TALK, T-A-L-K, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.